8 plane flights, 15 charter buses, and $1.2 million. What it takes for one high school band to get to the Rose Parade. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, December 30th. Good to have you with us. The fight over auto parts and service chain Pep Boys has come to an end. Carl Icahn has been declared the winner over Japanese tire maker Bridgestone. Icahn's winning bid, $1 billion. But the thing is, Icahn would have won even if he lost. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains the strategy behind one of the world's best-known activist investors.
Let's just take a quick look at what Icahn did here. A while back, he bought 12% of Pep Boys. Then he threatened to buy more of Pep Boys to take it over. Well, all kinds of people freaked out, and other people started bidding for the company.
Getting a bidding war going, which drives up the stock price.
Peter Cohen teaches strategy and entrepreneurship at Babson College. So even if Icahn lost the bidding war, he's driven up the stock price and can cash out at a profit.
He's done this over and over again over the years.
Now, in this case, he actually will very likely get control of the company, which he can then rearrange or improve the operations of or sell for parts like he's done on occasion in the past. Either way, he wins. But over the last 30 years that Icahn has been at this, a central element to his strategy really has been cage rattling.
Get into a company that's not performing well, buy shares, get on the board, frighten management.
Mark Stevens is the author of King Icahn and CEO of marketing firm MSCO.
Threaten the guys who are running the company that they're going to lose their jobs or lose control of their company.
Unless they do something to improve the stock price or dividends, somehow reward investors. And by investors, we mean reward Carl Icahn. Now, a common criticism of this approach is that it can be very short-term focused. Again, Peter Cohen.
What is the value that he's adding to the company? Really zero, but he is raising the stock price.
But as Robert Jackson, professor of law at Columbia, points out,
those gains are not just for the activists, but for all public company shareholders.
Now that Icahn is likely to get control over Pep Boys, it remains to be seen what he'll actually do with it. But as long as Icahn's around, Pep Boys probably won't be the last cage he rattles. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
As you've heard before on the show, Puerto Rico is in a mountain of debt, more than $70 billion. And it has another big payment due next week. Governor Alejandro Garcia Padilla announced today that he'll default on some of that debt. But Puerto Rico will make the payment on general obligation bonds, the debt with the strongest legal protections, and arguably the most important debt to keep current on. Puerto Rico cannot legally declare bankruptcy. So unless Congress acts, that's not an option. Marketplace's Andy Euler is here to tell us what all this means. Hey, Andy.
Hey.
So how do we get here?
Well, it depends on who you ask, but a lot of people point to essentially U.S. tax code. So for a century, the federal government was granting big tax incentives to companies that would either be based in Puerto Rico or had subsidiaries there, and you would get even more tax benefit from having a business there on the island. What was happening then was tons of jobs were being created, pharmaceuticals, manufacturing, things like that. They decided to phase that out in 06, and jobs ended and poverty increased and people ended up leaving the island.
So what's going to happen early next week?
So a lot of accounting procedures, it sounds like. They're going to make a payment. But the way that they're going to do it is essentially taking money from the budget to pay the debt. So you have infrastructure projects, you have highway projects, things like that. But they're not going to commit those dollars that had been committed in the budget to those projects. What they're going to do is pay this debt now.
As Puerto Rico pulls more and more money from these infrastructure projects, from its budget, how's it affecting people in Puerto Rico?
So 100 schools have already closed. The utilities have massive debt. So you're talking about, whether or not the water can stay on, whether or not you're actually going to have electricity in houses in a lot of parts of Puerto Rico. And then there's just not investment for businesses that actually want to start there in Puerto Rico and have more jobs essentially there on the island and have money stay on the island. I talked to a woman who's a businesswoman there about exactly this.
We in Puerto Rico, of course, are in a funk. Because we just lost $50 billion of our personal money. Our banks have dropped. The preferred shares of our banks have dropped. Our real estate has dropped. And now our bonds have dropped.
That's Mirna Rivera. She's a business consultant there on the island.
And she talks about losing personal wealth.
Right.
How is this affecting the personal wealth of Puerto Ricans?
Well, first of all, a lot of residents bought a lot of these bonds, and those have lost value. And people who live in Puerto Rico now aren't confident to invest in Puerto Rico because they just don't know where that money's going to go. So if you're wealthy in Puerto Rico, if you have money in Puerto Rico, you're not spending it there. But a lot of the population just doesn't have a lot of money. 45% of the population is under the poverty line. And so, you know, the governor's saying, we're not worried about the rich people in Puerto Rico. We're not worried about that. We're worried about people that, like I said, don't have access to water and don't have access to electricity. And, you know, he should be worried about that. But what's happening to that money in Puerto Rico is that it's leaving.
What's it mean for those of us who aren't in Puerto Rico?
What's going to happen is it could potentially shake up the bond markets. And it's something akin to what was happening in Detroit a couple of years ago where, you know, if a municipality can't or a state or a commonwealth can't pay back its debt, then you have to think about kind of the value of those bonds. Now Congress is essentially being asked to figure out what's going to happen if and when these bonds are defaulted on.
Marketplace's Andy Euler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, Pep Boys was down right along with the rest of the markets. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Siemens, one of Germany's largest companies, is offering apprenticeships to refugees. It's one of a growing number of employers who think asylum seekers are vital to Germany's economic future. But as the BBC's Berlin correspondent Jenny Hill reports, not everyone's convinced.
Their faces are bright under the stark factory lighting, and the young men watch closely as their tutor demonstrates a piece of machinery. These are the engineers of tomorrow and the future of German industry. But they're not enough. Germany's population is aging fast. Soon, young, skilled workers will be hard to find. Which is why Siemens has employed a thin, dark-eyed young man. Ali is absorbed in his task, filing down a large chunk of metal. He doesn't want to talk about why he had to leave Iraq, but ask him about the apprenticeship he's just landed here, and his face lights up.
Well, now I can plan for the future. I can see myself in 10 years' time. What am I doing? What will my job be? Will I have a family? These are really important things for me, which should be available to everyone.
Ali still doesn't know whether he'll be granted asylum in Germany. But as the training officer, Lars Wissmann, says, for Siemens, it's a risk worth taking.
We believe refugees have a special quality, like the people we already take on from disadvantaged or migrant backgrounds. If you give them a chance and help them to develop, then they really fly. They're much more highly motivated than your average applicant.
But what about small businesses? In Germany, they're known as Mittelstand, and they matter. Often described as the backbone of the German economy, they employ two-thirds of the national workforce. This one near Chemnitz is typical.
Coming into this workshop is a little bit like stepping into Santa's grotto. All year round, they make wooden Christmas decorations. They use mainly pine and maple, and it smells lovely.
Peggy Köhler runs the business with her husband. The young people today, she says, don't really do craft work as much. Their motor skills are not as well developed. They're not motivated to become artisans. Would she employ refugees, I ask? Among them, there will be qualified woodworkers, she replies. And I could imagine employing one of them. But doing so involves red tape and investment, and there's no guarantee they'll be allowed to stay in Germany. A As the Siemens apprentices learn their craft, the German government is still grappling with its asylum policy. There's still bitter disagreement at the highest level over how to manage the vast number of people who've arrived in the country, let alone how to integrate them into the German labour market. And for many in the business community, it's an opportunity lost.
That was the BBC's Berlin correspondent, Jenny Hill. All up across the country, and there are over 1 million acres of land that are dug up and used for coal mining. But reclaiming those mines when the coal's tapped is expensive. You got to fill them up, replant, make it nice again. And as the coal industry struggles, there's concern that coal companies don't have the billions they promised to pay to clean it all up. Lee Patterson from Inside Energy reports.
I meet Carla Oxenden on a windy stretch of highway overlooking Eagle Butte Coal Mine, a cavernous open pit near Gillette, Wyoming.
Thanks for meeting me.
Nice to meet you.
She points past some power lines to her house. It's on a hill so close to the mine that she and her husband can feel it.
The shaking from the blast, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like an earthquake.
Over the years, they've managed to coexist. But now, Carla is concerned about the future of the mine. Its owner, Alpha Natural Resources, one of the largest coal companies in the country, has filed for bankruptcy. And regulators estimate it would cost over $400 million to restore Alpha's Wyoming mines, including this one. In its most recent financial filings, the company listed liabilities of 2.5 times greater than its assets. How and when most of those cleanup costs will get paid back is uncertain.
It would be a huge program to try to fill it all in, and hopefully they won't leave it for the taxpayer to pay the bill.
Leaving it to the taxpayers is exactly what is never supposed to happen. Federal law requires coal companies to financially guarantee eventual cleanup before mining even begins. But one type of financial guarantee that's behind billions of dollars in outstanding reclamation costs isn't much more than a promise. It's called self-bonding.
A self-bond is basically like an IOU.
Clark Williams Derry is with the Sightline Institute, a think tank focusing on sustainability, energy, and the environment.
It's just kind of a piece of paper that says, hey, you know what? I'm good for it.
Requirements vary state to state, but in order to self-bond, coal companies must first pass a test of financial strength.
And for a long time, it didn't seem to be much of a problem.
But now, in a struggling coal market,
big companies that seem to be too healthy to fail, too big to go under, that are approaching bankruptcy, and they've been self-bonding.
Of the top coal-producing states, Wyoming has the highest rate of self-bonding at 76%. Inside Energy calculated that in at least 4 more states, Colorado, North Dakota, Indiana, and Texas, more than half of the projected mine cleanup costs are backed by self-bonds. The top 2 coal-producing states, Wyoming and West Virginia in particular, are dealing with self-bonding issues as the coal industry contracts. Regulators here are now reviewing the state's self-bonding rules to make sure they still work. Todd Parfit is the director of Wyoming's Department of Environmental Quality. He says part of the problem is that the downturn in the coal industry happened so quickly.
If we could predict what the market was going to do, absolutely, you know, you could have gotten a bit of a head start on this. But could you really have seen at the time when the coal production was at its peak?
2? Okay.
It is a tough topic for everybody, I think, in the community.
Over lunch, Carla Oxenden, whose husband is a retired coal miner himself, describes a sort of catch-22. If weakened coal companies have to put up real money for cleanup, that could send them into bankruptcy. Alpha Natural Resources said as much in financial documents. Quote, failure to maintain self-bonding status could affect our ability to mine, unquote.
On the one hand, you want to see them do what's right. And on the other hand, you know, you understand that your friends and neighbors may still be going to work.
Other big coal companies could be right behind Alpha. Arch Coal and Peabody Energy together have nearly $2 billion worth of self-bonded mines all over the country. Arch recently announced it might soon file for bankruptcy, and in November, Peabody sold mines in Colorado and New Mexico. The deal will free the company of several liabilities, including over $300 million in self-bonding. I'm Lee Patterson for Marketplace.
That story comes to us from Inside Energy. Coming up,
we have 716 that actually made the trip here with us that'll be participating in the Rose Parade.
The expensive business of the high school band. But first, let's do the numbers. We always caution the markets are not the economy. And in this holiday vacation week, trading so light, the markets are barely even the markets. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 117.6%, ending at 17,603. The Nasdaq let go of 42.8% to finish at 5065. The S&P 500 slid 15.7% to close at 2063. Fewer people signed contracts to buy existing homes in November. Economists expected an increase. Realogy Holdings Corporation, which owns Century 21, Coldwell Banker, and Sotheby's International, dropped 3%. Remax Holdings, it dipped 0.4%. The first Oprah Winfrey ad for Weight Watchers aired, and Weight Watchers International shares lifted 19%. They've nearly tripled since Winfrey bought a stake in the company back in October. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.29%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is listener-supported, so please, to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st, and thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. When it comes to moving goods from Asia, like smartphones and cars, West Coast ports have an advantage over East Coast ports. That's because mega-sized ships can't make it through the Panama Canal, which links the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. But the Panama Canal is expanding, and when it opens to these mega ships, it could have profound consequences for the U.S. economy. Lauren Madelon of Marfa Public Radio reports from Panama.
6 hours, Roger. Locking up with you.
Tug Captain Luis Estribi is guiding a ship from China through a lock on its way to New Orleans. The ship is known as a Panamax, that is, the maximum size that can pass through this canal. But today, Panamax is passé.
Time now is money, and a lot of money.
Now it's all about post-Panamax, vessels with up to three times the cargo. But they're way too wide for the existing canal. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says post-Panamax ships now carry 45% of the world's cargo. The Panama Canal needs wider, deeper locks to remain relevant, and construction is underway. But the project has seen multiple delays, legal disputes, and huge cost overruns. Meet Oscar Bassan. He heads business development at the Panama Canal Authority. He says the new locks should open by spring.
The project has been very challenged with the contractors, legal issues, claims, and but we are moving forward.
Which is what tug captain Lou Stabler says is long overdue.
They had to.
Stabler was born in a canal zone that the U.S. ceded to Panama 15 years ago.
It's like being an airline and deciding, well, I don't really want to use jets. I'm going to stay with the props. You're not going to have the customers. You're not going to have the business. You're just going to go belly up.
That soundtrack of trucks and noise is construction on gargantuan new locks at the canal's Atlantic entrance. Work here is being mirrored in the U.S. This is Charleston, South Carolina. Rail already takes post-Panamax cargo from Europe and sends it inland. But right now, the port's only deep enough to take in that cargo at high tide, and that's about to change. From New York, New Jersey to Baltimore, Savannah, and Miami, workers are dredging, raising bridges, and upgrading docks.
Yeah, I think it's very exciting.
That's Jim Newsom, CEO at the Port of Charleston.
We will deepen our harbor from 45 to 52 feet to accommodate this tremendous new trend toward big container ships.
There will be winners and losers, says Noah Moore. He's professor of international business at George Washington University and co-author of The Big Ditch, an economic history of the Panama Canal. Among the winners, U.S. exporters of grain and cotton.
You're talking about a drop in shipping costs equal to about 3% of the market value of the product. That's big.
You know what else he said? That U.S. agribusiness will really benefit.
American cotton and grain that's currently not competitive in Asian markets will become competitive. So for American agriculture, that is a big deal.
But U.S. West Coast ports stand to lose, maybe big time, because it'll be cheaper to ship goods directly from Asia to the East Coast through the canal without stopping on the West Coast. Shipping by water will still take longer than sending cargo cross-country by rail from the West, but the water route will cost less.
6 hours, standby.
So the expansion may threaten some of the 4 million jobs in California, Oregon, and Washington specifically tied to Asian imports. Many of those jobs are in the ports. In Panama, tug captain Estribi is frustrated by the delays, but he's proud of the expansion and the canal's legacy.
And we're still, nowadays, we are wondering how these engineers, how they built it. This was amazing how they think in every single detail. Every part of the canal have its own story, and good ones.
Estribi and other captains are looking forward to training in the new locks. In Panama, I'm Lauren Madelon for Marketplace.
Every year, a handful of high school marching bands are selected to perform on New Year's Day at the Rose Parade in Pasadena. They'll march past throngs of people on the street and millions of people on television. One of the bands you'll see if you tune in on Friday will be the Allen Eagle Escadrille from Allen, Texas. Wearing blue, white, and black, 700 strong, they're going to be hard to miss. I headed over to the Rose Bowl while the band was having its picture taken and caught up with the director, Blaine Hinton. I asked him what it took to get the band here.
It's really a big deal for us. First of all, it's about an 18-month process that we had to get together with applications, letter of recommendations from public officials, from community leaders. You have to put together a really nice 2 or 3 minute video. And of course, we went all out. We had our kids meet one day after school. We paraded up in front of the school and did all this stuff. Each person had to come up with $1,600. We fundraised about $135,000. Through corporate donations, car wash, made $10,000 in one day. That's not too bad.
Wow.
And then we sold mattresses, if you can believe that. We sold national record mattresses, 140 mattresses for about $25,000.
That was your takeaway from those mattresses?
That was our takeaway from it, right. So, and then we were able to share that with the kids, about $200 each. So it's about $1,400 that they had to come up with.
So all told, so how big is the total band, and then how big was your total traveling crew?
We have 716 that actually made the trip here with us that'll be participating in the Rose Parade. And then we have 776 with chaperones and things like that that traveled with us on 8 plane flights, 2 charters, and then 6 commercial flights. And then we travel around in 15 charter buses to get from point A to point B, and that'll be going to Disneyland. We'll be performing a parade there this afternoon. We're going to be performing at Pasadena City College in a band fest that's an exhibition show for us.
So how much does this total thing cost? I mean, when you look at the total bottom line number, what's that look like?
Yep, this is always a fun fact to throw out to everybody. From beginning to end, to get us here and back home, it was $1.2 million.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big figure. And there again, we have to do a big shout out to our family and friends and community people in Allen, because they really got behind everyone here.
It's interesting, though. I mean, Texas has a reputation for being a football state, but not necessarily a band state.
Well, I don't think that we go outside as much as we need to, because there's so much competition in Texas. We battle each other at our Texas State Marching Contest. It's a lot of really good folks.
And what's it like to be here now when big parts of Texas and your neighbors are, there's tornadoes and flooding?
Yes, it was really scary. It was Saturday night before we left, and we were looking at the weather in Allen, where we all live. We were under a tornado warning. That means that there was a tornado near us. It was just to the east of us, and that's when it kind of all started. And we were worried about all the other bands that had to come from Ohio and Iowa and places like that. But they all made it because I saw them this morning at our band director's breakfast.
Well, congratulations to you.
Well, thank you, guys. Love sunny California. Thank you for the great weather. We appreciate everybody. Thank you.
This final note, going out on New Year's Eve is always expensive, but going out in Times Square in New York City is crazy. According to the New York Post, a meal at the Olive Garden in Times Square will set you back $400 per person. And that doesn't guarantee you a view of the ball drop or breadsticks. You'll pay about $800 each to eat at Bubba Gump Shrimp, $449 at the counter for just a mini burger and fries. I guess it's all supply and demand in action. But I can think of a lot of things I'd rather do with $1,000 than eat salmon and pasta at Buca di Beppo with my significant other. On the way out, it's a long weekend coming up for a lot of you. Perfect time to listen to some podcasts. There's our daily podcast and some new ones. We've got Codebreaker, Actuality, Corner Office. You can find them on your favorite podcast app or on marketplace.org. And that's our show for today. Today, the Dow was down 117.6%. The NASDAQ let go of 42.8%. And the S&P 500 slid 15.7%. Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I'm Adrian Hill. We'll see you again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.